Holland.
H? 2 in a bit. And what's your name? I don't think I ever knew.
Grace. He picks up the child and slowly lowers her into the ice bath. Claire wakes with a shudder. At first she whimpers, and then she screams.
Hold her there, he says. I'm going to prepare an injection.
Of what?
Penicillin, in case there's a bacterial infection. We won't know until morning when symptoms begin to present themselves.
Isn't a seizure a symptom?
It's a result of high fever, not the disease itself. Is your daughter allergic to penicillin?
I don't know. She's never had it. Grace fights to keep the slippery Claire in the tub. The fight goes against every instinct in her body. After Dr. Lightheart has prepared the injection, he says,
"Let's do this over here."
Grace lifts her daughter up and dries her with a towel, thinking, "This must be torture for Claire." The child is silent, relieved to be out of the bath.
"Put her on her side facing you. Keep talking to her."
Grace holds Claire's face and croons soothing words, but she doesn't miss the flash of the needle as it goes in. After a split second, Claire shrieks.
"That's good," the doctor says. "Listlessness isn't."
Grace wraps Claire in a dry towel and holds her close. The feeling of momentary relief is intense. Grace follows the doctor into a small room in which there are two cribs. He lowers the slats on the side of one of them.
"I'm going to cover her with only a light sheet. I'll be across the hall in my office. If there's a problem, just yell and I'll hear you. If you think she's too hot, if you spot a rash, if she seizes, if she vomits, if she starts to bark like a dog, anything you don't like, you come and get me."
Grace nods. She understands that he won't tell her that everything will be all right, because both he and she know that might not be the truth. Claire feels warm. What's the precise point at which warm becomes hot? Grace is reluctant to use the thermometer because Claire is asleep, and Grace knows the child needs rest. She lays her head against the slats of the crib. "It's too much," she nearly says aloud. The fire, the loss of the baby, Jean, and now Claire. If something should happen to Claire, Grace knows that she will break apart into pieces that will never be put back together again. Warm becomes hot, and a line is crossed. Grace stands unsure. Should she go to Dr. Lightheart, or should she try to take Claire's temperature herself? She lays the back of her hand against her child's forehead. She doesn't need a thermometer. At the threshold to the doctor's office, she pauses. He's fallen asleep on his desk, pushing a manual so close to the edge that Grace is amazed it hasn't fallen.
"Dr. Lightheart?" she calls.
The man rubs his face, and the manual falls to the floor. He checks his watch. 12:15, Grace knows from the big clock in the room where Claire is sleeping. He stands, his white coat wrinkled, and follows Grace.
"She's hot," she says.
He feels the skin under Claire's arm.
"She certainly is," he agrees. "When was the last time she had aspirin?"
"Maybe 7:30.
He fetches a brown glass bottle in a cabinet.
"Wake her and see if you can get her sitting upright."
The doctor crushes the aspirin in a spoon, then fills it with water.
"Do you want to do this?"
he asks.
"Yes," she says.
Grace lowers the slats and takes the spoon from the doctor while he props Claire up. She gently rubs the back of her finger against Claire's cheek. The child opens her mouth. The trick never fails, and Grace gets as much of the medicine into her as she can.
"Give her a second to digest that, and then we'll start the whole routine again."
"The ice bath?"
"I know of a father who ran out the door of his house and plunged into the snow with his 8-month-old son. Saved the kid's life." "A fellow who's the husband of one of my patients brought me a plate of turkey," Dr. Lightheart says, "and stuffing and potato. He apologized for the lack of cranberry sauce, explaining that the bogs had boiled. Needless to say, I was grateful. To make up for the sparse dinner, the guy produced a pumpkin pie. Mrs. had an extra, was how he put it. I don't know about you, but I could sure use a slice of that pie right now.
Thank you.
While he's gone, Grace gazes at Claire and tries to guess his age.
30? 35?
The white coat might make him look older than he really is, but there's a certain gravity in the face. She wonders why he wanted to exile himself to such a backwater area when, as a young doctor, he might have been drawn to a city hospital. He returns with a pie, two plates, forks, and napkins. Touching Claire again, Grace watches as he cuts two large pieces. The first bite of pie makes her close her eyes with pleasure. It might be the odd circumstances in which she's eating it, but she thinks the pie the best she's ever had. It's a dark pumpkin, tasting of mace.
This is delicious, she says.
I have to do a better job of remembering patients' names. I didn't recall the man's wife's name, but I could see her face as clear as day. The next time I see her, I'll thank her on your behalf.
For the first time all evening and night, Grace smiles. And not yours?
When I saw you last, he says after a time, you were pregnant.
I lost the baby.
Oh, I'm sorry. You have had a rough go of it, haven't you?
I won't deny it.
First things first, let's get this pretty little girl well.
Grace collects the dishes and the silverware and walks with unsteady steps to the kitchen, a long, narrow room with a white wooden counter. She covers the pie and puts it into the refrigerator, which is filled with medicines and two bottles of milk. For babies? For coffee? She locates the dish soap and sponge and washes the few items they used. She dries them with a towel and folds it neatly on top of the counter. She has trouble with a bathroom lock, though she can't see the need of it. Her hands shake so much that she can barely get her girdle down. When she sits, she examines her fingers, which tremble even when she clamps them together. Her face is wet with tears. She tears a length of toilet paper to wipe them off, a useless gesture since she then begins to cry in earnest. She knows she can't stop. It's the simple act of being alone, of closing a door. And perhaps it truly is the cumulative loss, one after another. But the tears feel different, purely physical, pure release. And when she is done, she feels better, though there has been no change in her circumstances. She puts herself together, washes her face and hands in the sink, dries herself with a towel, and stands back to examine her face in the mirror. Her eyes are swollen, the whites pink. Dr. Lightheart will know that she has been crying. Well, what does it matter? What has she got to hide now? He has a pad of paper on his lap and a pen in his hand, making notes. He's smiling when he looks up at her, but the smile fades.
What happened?
Does anything more need to have happened?
He closes the notebook, clips the pen to his coat pocket.
She's fine for the moment, he says. But the fever may climb again. We'll see.
You should get back to your work. We've taken up too much of your time. Besides, you need to sleep.
I think you need to sleep.
No, she says. I need to talk.
Were you in the war? She asks.
I was, a medic. I was in my second year of medical school when war broke out. I finished the year and enlisted.
What a horrible time you must have had.
It was pretty bad.
Do you ever speak about it? She asks.
If someone wants to know.
It's funny, because my husband hardly ever mentioned the war. It's been my experience that most men our age won't.
You can't blame them. No one wants to revisit horror or guilt.
Why do you say guilt?
You're given orders you don't think are right, but you have to do them anyway. Every day, there are choices to make, and sometimes you make a selfish one.
What's a selfish one?
Triaging a man you guess won't live past noon, though he's in line for surgery. Then you struggle with that decision for weeks.
For a moment, Grace is silent. If you don't mind my asking, how did you end up here? She asks.
After the war, I finished up med school, then just recently set out to hang my shingle. You get a map, and you shop for towns. If you're lucky, someone takes you in and grooms you. I didn't want hospital work. I'd seen enough of wards. I wanted a small-town family practice. After the fire, I'd heard that the local doctor's house had burned down, and that he had a temporary practice here, in this hut. I came here to visit him and to offer my help, and I could see he was in a state. I told him what I was looking for, and he seemed immensely relieved. We brought the lawyers in, and I bought the practice.
She scans the Quonset hut, the metal rivets showing. I hope you didn't pay a lot for it.
He laughs. The government owns the building. It's temporary. I hope to build a house with an office attached.
In Hunts Beach?
That's the idea.
You'll have an awfully small practice, she says. He glances at Claire, puts the back of his hand to her forehead.
If Hunts Beach were inland, I'd agree with you. Few families would want to rebuild in a place with no infrastructure. No schools, police, fire department. But Hunts Beach will always be valuable land because it's coastal. It will repopulate. Whether it will be with the original inhabitants, I can't say.
He pauses.
It's as if you're part of a diaspora now.
Grace is unsure of the word.
A scattering of people from their homeland. Displaced.
She nods. The Jews. She has seen the movie reels. Horrifying and unimaginable. She glances out the window. The snow is still falling. Will her children be taught about the Jews at school?
But what about you? He asks.
Grace tells him about her father, the secretarial course, meeting Jean at the small college to which they both commuted, and marrying him before they'd started their second year. She doesn't tell the doctor that when she met Jean, she thought him handsome and serious, in contrast to the boys she'd been meeting at parties, and she took that seriousness for depth of character. She doesn't tell him that they married when Grace discovered she was pregnant, and that Jean began to shake with either anger or great happiness.
This is good. This is what I've always wanted, she told herself. And if it wasn't as romantic or as heedless as she had once hoped for, it was fine.
You mind if I smoke? The doctor asks.
Not at all. He offers her one, and she takes it. He crosses his legs and hangs an arm over the chair. He looks casual and very long.
Tell me more about your husband.
He's a surveyor on the Turnpike Project. His mother died recently. I expected him to mourn, but I didn't expect the silence. She takes a pull on the cigarette. I used to count up the number of words he said to me in a given day. Sometimes it was only two. When I was a girl, I always thought I'd marry the strong, silent type. But what a bore, really.
You have friends? He asks.
I used to have a very good friend. But after the fire, she and her husband and children went to live in Nova Scotia.
There you go, the diaspora. Why so far?
They have family there. Rosie was wonderful. She made me happy every day. She pauses. Nearly everyone in Hunts Beach is now homeless. Many are destitute.
There'll be no charge for tonight.
Oh, I didn't mean that, she's quick to say. I'll pay. Of course, I'll pay. You can't very well start a practice without the patients paying.
I'm going to set up a sliding scale. When I've assessed the general income level of the patients, I'll determine my fees.
Is that legal?
It's time-honored.
You'll have a bookkeeping mess, she says.
You know bookkeeping?
I do, and I'll pay the standard rate because you just saved my daughter's life.
You saved your daughter's life by getting her here. Seizures can be very dangerous.
Grace remembers the awful moment in Gladys's house.
Let's just say she's a lucky girl, he offers.
Will she really be all right?
We'll see in the morning, but I think so.
In the morning, Claire's cheeks are bright red, her tongue white, her throat raw, and she has a rash over her chest and arms. All the symptoms point to scarlet fever, Dr. Lightheart explains.
Any children around her have it?
He asks as the sun rises through the window.
None that I can think of, Grace answers.
It can be serious, and it spreads easily. You have another child at home?
Yes.
Can you put Claire in a room by herself? She has to be quarantined. You know what that entails?
Grace thinks about the arrangements, the three of them in the attic. Tom will have to sleep with his grandmother. Claire and I can sleep together in one room.
I'd like to keep her here for 24 hours, but I'm going to have to put you both in an isolation room. The receptionist and a nurse will be in this morning. I'll leave a note on the front desk as to where you are, as well as the diagnosis.
The nurse, Amy, has Claire fill out a card requiring name, address, phone number, blood type, previous illnesses, both for her and for Claire. Grace can do the name and her previous illnesses, measles, chickenpox, tonsils out, but the address and phone number are not her own. She wonders how much money she has in her purse, and if she can pay the doctor in full today so that he needn't bill her. Amy offers Grace a gown, bathrobe, and slippers, none of which fit her well. Her legs are bare from above her knees to her ankles, which would be fine if she were the patient. Not fine as a regular woman. The slippers are small and insubstantial, but she can hardly put her good heels on with the gown and robe. Claire frets, cries, and coughs most of the morning, which Grace knows is a good sign. Her child isn't listless. According to the doctor, Claire likely has a terrible sore throat and a headache. Grace tries to explain to her daughter that she's sick and will get better soon, but time means nothing to a young child. An hour, 2 days, 4 days. It hurts now. That's all she knows. An hour, 2 days, 4 days. It's all Grace knows, too. Barbara, the receptionist, never makes it in, having skidded into a tree early in the morning. This, according to Amy, who gives Claire a cool sponge bath.
I keep telling her, come in later than usual on an icy or snowy morning. Give the plows a chance. But her husband, Bert, tells her that it's best to be the first car on the road. Less danger of hitting anyone else if you skid out. Guess he forgot about trees. Bert's an idiot. He knows all about drilling for wells, but hasn't an iota of common sense. Strange for a man, don't you think? And Barbara, she does what he tells her. I hope she's not hurt, but I've got my hands full now. I have to keep checking the waiting room because there's no one there to tell us someone needs attention.
Don't bother with us, Grace says. I can handle everything myself. You can probably take her temperature regularly, but you can't do the injections.
Injections?
Yes, she's due at 6 tonight.
Of the antibiotic?
Amy looks at her as if Grace, too, might be dim.
For 10 days, Amy explains.
But Dr. Lightheart said the symptoms should subside in 5 days.
That's true, but you have to do the complete course with antibiotics or else the illness could come back, sometimes in a more virulent form. When the doctor sends you away, he'll give you a prescription for an oral fluid she can take by the spoonful.
When Claire finally falls asleep, Grace climbs onto the adult-sized cot and pulls up the sheets. She turns to her side to be able to keep an eye on her daughter. She has to do better by her children. She can't live on the kindness of others indefinitely. She's made good progress in her driving, but what she really needs is a job in a village or a city in which she can walk to work, get a babysitter, and do her shopping on foot. With her mother's help, until she can get a paycheck, she might just be able to swing a one-bedroom apartment in a city. But which city? Biddeford? Portland? Portsmouth? Her thinking stops there as she begins to drift off. Her mind fills with images of scintillating snowfields and someone, a child, in the distance. She strains to hear but can't. Music. 38 days after the fire, and Grace has lived a lifetime. Claire is outside, Gladys pulling her on a sled along a path. While Grace's mother, glad that her daughter has emerged from quarantine, seems chirpy on the snow-covered winter day.
"I think he's just about ready to walk," Marjorie says of Tom. "All the time I had him, he was holding on between the hassocks and the side tables and the chairs. I feel as though I've been away for a very long time. When I think of what you've been through, well, I may have been mad at you briefly here and there, but you can't imagine the admiration I have for you."
During her week at Claire's side, Grace had hours to try to solve her seemingly insurmountable problem. She, her children, and her mother can't live in Gladys's house indefinitely. Grace has to find another place for them, or at least convince the building commission to put her near the head of the line for a new house. She's a single parent without a home. Won't they view that situation as more dire than that of a family with multiple adults to earn money? But even if she were to persuade an official today, it will take months for the house to be ready. One night when she can't sleep, she has a thought that at first repulses her, and then begins to seem sensible. If Gladys will loan her the Chevrolet, Grace can drive to Merle Holland's house to see if it's empty. If it is, she can bring her children and her mother there. Her mother can watch the children while Grace looks for work. They won't have to furnish a home, and in the spring, there will be flowers. There are plenty of bedrooms for all of them, and it has the added advantage of being the first place Gene might go when he returns from wherever he's been. By morning, the plan has solidified.
"Mother, I have an idea. What if I were to take a drive to Merle Holland's house, Gene's house now, and if I find it empty, we, the kids, me, you, could move in there? It would be housing, and it would take the burden off Gladys and Evelyn. We could open all the windows for a few minutes, let in fresh air, see to the linens and pots and pans. It's possible there's an entire house ready for us to inhabit."
"But it would be trespassing," her mother says.
"Not really. Think about it. Gene inherited the house. He's missing. I'm his wife. These are his children. He would want us to have shelter."
"But how could you settle into the house of a woman who never had a good thing to say about you?"
"Times have changed, Mother. I've changed. I could settle into her house just fine. And, if I recall, there's a nursery with a crib and toys. I'll go first to make sure it hasn't been taken over by squatters or by a long-lost cousin of Jean's I've never heard of. I might try to do some dusting, make sure the utilities haven't been turned off. The house has never been listed for sale because Gene wanted us to move there." She pauses. "If he only knew."
"Well, it's a thought. I do feel a bit in the way here."
Grace meets her mother's eyes and knows she understands the relationship between Gladys and Evelyn. How could she not? Grace would like to query her mother further, but now is not the time. If Grace moved into Merle's, she would have to relinquish access to a car, a hardship after having learned to drive. There has to be a bus, she reasons, that travels along the coast road. It's only then that it occurs to her that Merle's house might have burned to the ground as well. Her anxiety builds as she drives toward the shore and sees that most of the coastal land is black. When she turns the corner to enter Merle's neighborhood, however, she sees that the houses are intact. She pulls into the driveway as if she were a newcomer to a bridge group. Jean had a key to the house, but she doesn't. There's nothing to search, not Jean's pockets, not a drawer in which he might have left the key. She climbs the stairs, and as she suspected, the door is locked. She lifts up mats, sticks her finger into flower pots, reaches for ledges. She descends the steps and walks to one side of the house, searching for a window that might be partially raised. Now that she's here, the urge to break into the house is strong. She scans basement windows, tries the bulkhead, and attempts to shimmy a window that looks unlocked but is stuck. By the time she's reached the back of the house, she's nearly given up. She tries the porch door, and it opens. She tries the back door, and it gives. How simple. It's then that Grace hears music and freezes. Someone in the house is playing a record. Or does the music come from a radio left on? She moves cautiously toward the hall, the one that leads to both the sitting room and the turret. The music grows louder each step she takes, and she realizes it's coming from upstairs. It has to be Jean. He's alive. Part of her wants to run up the stairs, shouting his name, and part of her is mortified. If it's Jean, why is he living here without her? Why has he not taken the trouble to find his wife and children? She can see in her mind's eye a sweep of the keyboard, a rumbling of deep chords, while the melody skips along, and that's how it feels, the melody skipping. And then the two are brought together in a powerful crescendo that causes hairs to rise at the back of her neck and her eyes to close. The sound is pure, sublime. It can't be a record or a radio broadcast. She finds a chair next to a telephone table, and ever so quietly, so as not to disturb, she sits. She had no idea her husband was talented in this way. Grace is reminded of tinkling broken glass, then of someone in great command, then of a deep and primitive growl from the lower notes. The melody, partially melancholic, moves her. It seems to seep through her skin and find its way to her center. Is it from musical notes that true longing is born? The desire to have the same thing again and again? After all, a mother's song to an infant is a melody. Childlike and not always beautiful, but it's a touchstone that one might long for in life. Grace craves the delicate touch of fingers on the keys, which she feels as fingers along the back of her neck. She bends her head. The music ends. Footsteps from a room into an upper hallway. Perhaps Jean sees Grace's boots. She can hear him coming down the stairs. She can't stand. Not yet. There's a moment of hesitation. Both Grace and the stranger begin to speak at once. You play beautifully.
I didn't know the house was inhabited. I beg your pardon.
I beg your pardon.
I have nowhere to go.
This house.
It seemed uninhabited.
It is. It isn't. How did you get in?
Houses like these are always easy to get into. Impossible to secure.
I think. This house belongs to my husband. I'm Grace Holland.
Aiden Byrne.
They shake hands. His grip is warm. Grace sets the kettle to boil, finding tea, sugar, a little milk, and producing from a cupboard a package of Lorna Doone cookies. She wonders if Aiden Byrne, too, lost everything in the fire. He's at least 6 feet tall. He wears his light brown hair long. His eyes are light brown, she concludes, during the brief glances her way. He has on a navy sweater and gray wool pants in the drafty house. She interrupted him in his slippers. "When did you come here?" she asks.
"The afternoon the fire hit Kennebunk. We were in the middle of rehearsals when men warned us through bullhorns to get out of town.
We packed up quickly and fled to waiting cars, and I managed to snag a seat. Then they led us out on Route 1 with no instructions. They said they had to go back into the village to rescue more. We could hardly complain.
He takes a sip of tea and holds out the plate of cookies to Grace. She takes one.
We started walking away from the fire, he continues. Those who knew the area slipped down dirt roads leading to cottages, but we could see that the fire was beginning to invade the woods along the coast. We started running. When I looked up the hill, I caught sight of a piano in a round room. Just a glimpse, and I peeled off. I played until nearly 8 in the morning.
What were you playing just now? Grace asks. She has on Joan's blue wedding suit, having decided she should dress up a bit for Merle's house.
Brahms' second piano concerto.
You can play that from memory?
A lot of people can. Well, not a lot. A few. It's meant for an orchestra and a piano.
I was moved, Grace admits.
By what exactly? I've always been curious about this. By how music affects people.
The melody, she says, setting down her cup. The passage that keeps getting repeated in different forms. The hairs stood out at the back of my neck. She pauses, embarrassed. I'm not explaining this well.
For some, the concerto is purely an intellectual pleasure. You sound as though you absorbed it through the skin.
Yes, that's it. Through the skin.
Didn't you listen to music in your home?
The radio.
You'll have to get some records.
She nods, but wants to protest that she hasn't any money, which leads her to her next thought, the reason why she's here. I have 2 children, she says. My husband, Jean, went off to make a fire break, and he didn't come home. His body was never found.
I'm very sorry.
Yes, thank you. It's awful, but there's another problem. Our house burned down, and I have nowhere to live. At the moment, we're living in the attic of a friend of my mother's, but we can't stay there indefinitely. Then I remembered this house. Jean inherited it when his mother died.
I'll leave, of course, he says. I can be gone by evening.
Grace wants to touch his fingers. How can so much magic come from them? Are your fingers insured? She asks.
My hands.
They'd have to be, wouldn't they?
I can't do anything else except play the piano.
I don't want to make you leave, Grace admits reluctantly. I'd like to be able to hear that music again. She blushes and bends her head. The world is so dreary, so awful now.
Everything in the house seems to be working fine, as far as I can tell, he offers. Good hot water. The stove works. Can't speak for the oven. The steam heat is better on the second floor than on the first.
Don't go anywhere tonight, she says. Perhaps, she thinks, he can remain as a tenant. The money would be a relief, a source of income while she looks for a job. When I come back with the children and my mother in the morning, we'll have made a decision. If you would, could you unlock the front door starting around 9? Before Grace can tell her mother about the man at Merle's house, she needs to be sure it's what she wants. It doesn't take her long to decide that the man must stay, somehow, in some capacity. The decision surprises her. She knows nothing about Aiden Byrne. He might be an escaped convict. He might be a leech. He might be a spy who will endanger them all. But Grace feels certain he is only an evacuee who was interrupted in the middle of a rehearsal by a fire. Grace has to wait until 2 o'clock, when everyone goes up for a nap, Gladys and Evelyn included. Her mother doesn't leave the kitchen, however, knowing that her daughter has news to deliver. They sit, her mother with a dish towel in her hand. Well, she asks. The house is open and is in good shape, and we can move in any time. But it seems we have a tenant. A tenant? Paying rent?
Well, that's the thing. We haven't established that yet. I'm confused. Grace lights a cigarette. There is a pianist on the second floor. He was being evacuated during the fire, and he saw the piano in the turret. Curiosity compelled him to enter the house. He's been there since the night of the fire. A squatter? A squatter with immense talent, and he's offered to leave. Well then, her mother says, setting the folded dish towel on the table. That's settled. Well, not really, Grace says. I think we should let him stay. Why? Will he pay good rent? I'm sure he will, but that's not the only reason. The music is beautiful. The kids and you and I have had so little in the way of beauty or music in our lives. Music won't pay the bills, her mother says. And what kind of a man just squats in the house without trying to find out who the owners are? Oh, come on, mother. You know it's been happening all up and down the coast of Maine. She taps her ash into the saucer. Gladys and Evelyn don't smoke. If he has no credentials, we can't trust him. I'm sure he does have credentials. I just didn't ask. But I talked to him. I liked him. I think he's trustworthy. Her mother seems about to remind her of instances when her instincts didn't pay off, but she holds her tongue. I want to go back with you and the children tomorrow, just to see the place, says Grace. It might be good to have a man close by, her mother suggests. To fix things, I mean. There may be one slight hitch. The piano is in the turret on the second floor. It's part of Merle's bedroom. I can only let him stay if he arranges to move the instrument down to the turreted parlor. How can he do that? The stairs are wide, but my guess is that they'll take out one of the long windows and use a crane to get it down. They'll have to take out a window in the parlor, too, to get it back in. Is all that necessary? I think so. The children and I will take over Merle's bedroom. I want them near me for now. And you have your choice of rooms on the third floor. One of them is a turret room, too. I already have my own room, her mother sniffs, doubtless thinking of the house that burned down. You don't anymore, Grace gently reminds her. But what about the man? Where's he going to sleep? There's a library on the first floor, just off the kitchen. It's a good-sized room, and we can move a bed down there. Then he'll have everything he needs. A bed, a bathroom, his piano, and access to the kitchen. Not a bad little apartment. You've thought this all out. I have, says Grace. As they climb the stairs, Claire, whose eyes dart from side to side, seems to remember the house. Marjorie holds Tom while Grace opens the front door. Aiden has raised all the shades to let light in, and Grace can't find a mote of obvious dust. They didn't talk about whether or not he should be present, but he seems to have made a decision not to be. The light coming in the windows both enhances and detracts from the rooms. She notes a water stain on an expensive antique table, claw marks from a dog at the side of one of the sofas, a bit of threadbare carpet. It's all fine, even better that way. Grace needn't worry about the children hurting the furnishings. Grace leads her mother, Tom, and Claire into the dining room, and then into the yellow and white kitchen. Perhaps remembering the last time she visited this house, Claire tries to open drawers, looking for the wooden utensils her mother got out for her. I like this, her mother says, gazing at the large windows. Grace shows them the library she means to use as Aiden's bedroom if he agrees. She leads the entourage up the carpeted curved staircase. They enter the room that once was Merle's. Claire runs to the dressing table and wants to touch the jewelry there. Not now, Grace admonishes. Her mother has wandered into the turret, where the piano is. My goodness, her mother says. How are they ever going to get this thing out?
We'll see how badly Aiden wants to stay, won't we? Says Grace.
Aiden?
Aiden Byrne.
Where's he from?
Grace doesn't know.
You can ask him when you meet him.
Now to the third floor.
Grace's memories of a nursery are correct. There's a crib and a wall of wooden toys, all neatly lined up. A rocking chair, childlike paintings on the walls, a small lamp decorated with rabbits. Claire runs toward the toys, and even Tom strains to be put down.
You go explore the rooms, Grace says to her mother. I'll watch the children.
Grace has them seated around the enameled kitchen table as she pours tea for her mother and her, milk for the children. She finds the bag of Lorna Doones and is glad there are still several left.
I like this room, her mother repeats.
So do I, Grace adds.
Me too,
Claire says.
Which room did you pick out? Grace asks her mother.
I think I like the turret bedroom, her mother confesses shyly. The views are very special.
I'm glad, says Grace.
She doesn't mention that it was Jean's bedroom when he was a boy. The doorbell rings in the kitchen as well as in the parlor. Brushing crumbs off her hands, Grace walks to the front door. She thinks, good timing. She says,
hello.
I thought it would be better this way, replies Aiden. Didn't want to seem like I lived here.
Smart. Come into the sitting room with me, and then I'll take you out to the kitchen to meet my family.
Aiden has on a good suit, an even better pair of black shoes. His concert clothes, she guesses. He's trimmed his hair.
I'd like you to stay, she says. But there's one hitch.
And what's that?
He asks. I want to take over the second floor. My children and I will sleep there. So the piano will have to be moved downstairs. Aiden raises an eyebrow, and she can see him pondering that reality. Is he thinking of the size of the windows, the expense to move it, or the possible loss of quality of sound?
Big undertaking, he says, sitting back.
Yes. I hate to ask, but can you afford such an operation?
I can, he says without hesitation. Traveling soloists sometimes have good spells.
You'll agree then?
Yes, I'll agree. But you risk harming the piano. And I can't say if the quality of the sound comes from being situated where it is. I guess we'll just have to find out.
I'd like to leave it where it is, Grace admits. But I have to have a place for me and my children. I think my mother would find it awkward if we all slept on the third floor with you on the second.
I'm sure the instrument will survive. Where would I sleep?
Have you wandered into the library?
Grace crosses her ankles. Because she wouldn't wear the blue suit again, she has on a red sweater and a gray wool skirt. The skirt was Gladys's and doesn't fit her well.
We'll make up a bedroom for you in there.
Aiden nods.
And there's one more thing. Grace hesitates. We'll have to sort out some kind of rent.
The music ought to be enough, she thinks.
More than enough.
Grace names a price she thinks is fair. Aiden agrees without further comment.
I should warn you, my mother will want references. She won't say it to you, but I'll have to produce something.
That's not a problem, he says.
Grace's family stares at the stranger she brings into the kitchen. He walks straight to her mother and says,
I'm pleased to meet you, Aiden Byrne.
Bold Claire stands on the table, as if wanting to make sure the stranger notices her.
And who are you, little girl?
He asks, gently shaking her hand.
I'm Claire. I'm two. I'm bigger than two.
Are you now?
Claire, please don't stand on the table, Grace warns. Claire complies by sitting on the table.
And this little one?
Aiden asks, chucking Tom under his chin.
This is Tom, Grace explains and gestures for Aiden to sit in the extra chair. Aiden and I have worked out arrangements, she announces to her mother, who is too polite to ask what they are in front of the stranger.
Claire, you like this house, don't you? Asks Grace.
Claire, thoughtful, surveys the kitchen, as if assessing it. She gives an exaggerated nod.
So I think we'll move in tomorrow, Grace says to Aiden.
You needn't move the piano just yet, but I do wonder if you could manage to get a bed into the library.
I can take a bed apart and bring it down in pieces, and then put it back together again, he offers.
Before we go today, my mother and I will sort out the linens to make sure you have everything you need. And while I have the car, I'll go to the grocery store. When we move, I won't have an automobile. It belongs to the woman whose house we're currently staying in.
The market isn't even a mile away. I can help you with that when you no longer have the car.
You're very kind.
You're very generous, he says.
I'm not that generous, Grace says. Would you mind playing something for my mother?
The adults rearrange the chairs in Merle's bedroom turret so that the seats are to one side of Aiden. Grace wants to see his hands, which she was only able to imagine when she first heard him. With Tom on her lap, her mother to one side, and Claire to the other, she watches Aiden remove his jacket and take his place on the bench. He rolls his sleeves. She has no idea what to ask him to play since she doesn't know the names of classical pieces, but he seems to sense that, or he simply wants to play what pleases him, because he starts in straight away with his right hand only, and then after a minute, allows the left to crash in. Claire comes alert with a start. Tom claps. And then Grace can hear the melody, the notes that will repeat themselves during the piece. With her mother beside her, she's careful not to betray, except with a smile, the sensations she experiences. She has a nearly overwhelming desire to bend her head, bare her neck, and let the tensions of the day leave her. She examines Aiden's fingers, stretching, reaching, confident, fast. She studies his face, a visage of perfect concentration. She doesn't think she has that ability, to focus so acutely on a task that nothing else matters, to be able to do this any time one wants. What a perfect gift. She has often wished she could sing. How heavenly to be able to entertain herself in that way. But the playing is something different. When the piece comes to a close, she thinks it ridiculous that she even mentioned rent. He seems a nice young man, her mother says as they leave Merle's driveway. Both children are asleep on the back seat.
Indeed, says Grace. I thought he was very polite. Good manners.
Yes.
And very well spoken, adds her mother.
He is.
And I liked the way he played children's songs for Claire at the end.
Nice.
And the music, really. I'm not sure I've ever...
Nor I.
I wonder where he went to school. He must have gone to music school.
Hmm.
He's Irish, I think. His name.
Maybe.
The Rooneys are Irish, her mother points out. Very nice people.
They are.
And I have to admit, he's handsome.
Mother, it's amazing good luck that you found him when you did.
At Gladys's house that evening, as her mother attempts, in an awkward way, to explain why it is they will have to leave, all Grace can think about is Aiden's hands. She imagines them muscular and flexible, the skin soft, the reach long. For how many years has he been playing? Since he was a small child? And how did he come upon such a gift? One doesn't learn talent. And why is he not playing in New York or Boston, with the orchestras they have there? Gladys, strangely, has tears in her eyes, which immediately produces a teary Marjorie.
"You've been so kind to us," her mother says. "I hope you know how grateful we are."
"Gladys is soft-hearted, if you haven't noticed yet," says Evelyn, sniffing and giving no sign of sadness at the prospect of their four guests leaving imminently. "And you'll come visit us," Grace adds. "Just as soon as we have the place fixed up, you must come for a meal." One meal as payback for dozens? Absurd. Somehow Grace will find a way to recompense them for all the provisions. Or would they mind that? She wonders if her mother will stay close friends with the two women, if she's unhappy to be going. In the morning, they pack, making the beds with fresh linen, leaving the room spotless. To move from one attic room for the four of them to a house more than a dozen times larger is dizzying. Aiden seems to have had no trouble rounding up a crew of out-of-work men who agree to move the piano. Though the thermometer reads only 43 degrees outside, the upper window has to be taken out while the piano is attached to a crane that has made deep grooves on the front lawn. Grace's mother can't bear to look and spends most of the day in the kitchen, rearranging the dishes and pots and pans to her liking. She then makes all the beds, including Aiden's. For his part, Aiden is meticulous in his instructions, not wanting to harm the piano in any way, and especially not wanting to leave the piano in the cold for a second longer than necessary. Grace and Aiden move all the furniture out of the way and agree that some of it will have to go down to the basement. Grace, with her arms wrapped tight around her chest, hardly dares to watch the piano come back into the house. Aiden is calm, but quick with an instruction if he thinks something about to go awry. He has on the blue sweater and gray pants he wore the day she met him. Grace has on the same thing she wore yesterday. Claire and Tom haven't been let out of Grace's mother's sight, everyone fearful for their safety.
"My God," Aiden says when the piano finally comes to rest and is correctly positioned. Even the crew seems chuffed at their success. The first floor window is in place, the lights turned on. Aiden, before he has even paid his men, sits down at the bench, plays some runs, listens, plays them again, listens again, reaches for the bass, repeats that, plays the upper keys and the lower together, produces a small smile, and then launches into Yankee Doodle Dandy, which causes the men to laugh and then to sing. Grace's mother emerges with the children. Claire, having an audience, begins to dance in her herky-jerky way, making sure everyone notices. Grace's mother produces cider and cookies, which the men accept eagerly. If she didn't know better, Grace might think there was a party at Merle Holland's house. Her house now. Sometimes Grace imagines Jean coming to the old Victorian, his surprise and unhappiness at seeing the piano in the front room, Grace and their children and her mother installed in various beds upstairs. Her old way of life seems lonely to her now. She fears it the way one might a recurring nightmare. She knows she must hope for Jean's return, but she's afraid to open the door to him. Grace's mother, who seems both exhausted and happy, retires with the children shortly after 8 o'clock. Grace, with a cup of cocoa, walks into the sitting room across from the turreted parlor and finds Aiden in a chair, reading a book. He stands. Grace shakes her head. "You needn't stand for me." She sets her cup down on a wobbly side table. "Please use every room. We want you to be comfortable." "That's very kind," he says. "But you must be tired."
"If I need to be by myself, I can always go upstairs, to my suite. You have no idea how small the house my husband and I lived in was."
"I think I can imagine," he says.
"Are you happy with the piano?"
Does he hesitate just a second?
"It's good. I am."
"I'm not sure I believe you," she says.
Well, there are one or two notes that are slightly off. I'm not sure the average person would notice, and I'm confident that a piano tuner can fix them.
Grace is silent.
It's one of the best pianos I've ever played.
Can't be. It hasn't been used in years.
I love it.
It's an odd make. I've never heard of it.
German. Very rare.
The moving changed the notes?
It's impossible to move a piano and not do something to it. I'm happy with the tone, though.
Grace feels vaguely guilty. If she hadn't insisted on Merle's room, the damage would not have happened. But having a man upstairs with all of them would have been untenable. She refuses to feel guilty. She can't afford guilt now. After a time, Aiden picks up his book and continues to read. Grace removes a slip of paper and a pencil from her skirt pocket and makes a list of all the items she must take care of in the morning. How quiet the house is. How awkward she feels. In another woman's sitting room with a man she doesn't know. Did the fire do all of this? She remembers Dr. Lightheart speaking of the diaspora. Aiden is part of that as well. Where does he belong? Jean must have died, she realizes with an inner jolt. He would not have walked away from this house. He would not have walked away from his children. A chill settles around her shoulders as she thinks of him dead, his flesh burned away, his white bones in a cornfield or on a forest floor, perhaps disturbed by animals. She imagines the agony of such a death. And to have no resting place, no grave where his wife and children can go to pay their respects, to remember him. It's not right. She shifts in her chair. She wonders how long it will take to replace all her painful memories with fond ones. 100 years, she thinks. At least 100 years. Aiden. The sitting room, with all the lights lit, seems a friendly place. Grace has taken to migrating toward the room after the children are in bed, because Aiden is often there. She has asked her mother to join her, but the older woman always begs off and goes upstairs.
Are you Irish?
Grace asks him one evening.
I am, he says, looking up from his book.
He greets Grace when she enters by half-standing. Do you speak Gaelic?
I used to.
You haven't got a brogue.
I lost it.
Grace opens her book at the bookmark. Why?
Irish need not apply.
Still?
Still.
Is Byrne an Irish name?
It can be. It can also be French.
Aiden speaks a French sentence with Byrne in it. The E in the name sounds halfway twisted around.
Or German.
He says a long, harsh sentence in a German accent, and Grace can't even tell where the burn is.
Or even Danish.
He spouts Danish, and she hears the burn, with barely a second syllable, like an afterthought. Grace, in the sitting room, studies him.
You made all that up, didn't you?
He smiles.
Maybe.
After she has left the sitting room and gone up to her bedroom, Grace checks that the children are asleep and then stands facing the window. She stares at her feet. As she tries a few steps, the rhythm and the dance begin to come back to her. She straightens her back, puts her arms to her sides, and starts to execute the most rudimentary of steps. She wishes she had taps on her shoes. It was the clicking of the metal toes that was so satisfying. With no one to watch her, Grace stares straight ahead, never look at your feet, and moves sideways in a linear fashion across the room, then forward and back as best she can remember. After school twice a week, Grace accompanied Patty Rooney to her Irish step dancing classes. Grace didn't dance, merely watched. But occasionally after the class, Patty would teach her a few steps. At a dance recital that Patty took her to, Grace remembers sitting in the audience with Mrs. Rooney, loving the precision that